Alright. Okay, so welcome to the Nuns Questions and Answers. We have a box full. But I thought we'd just start by just saying who we are, just briefly our names. We're not 1, 2, 3, 4. So I'm Venerable Upeka, and we're all from Dharamsala Nuns Monastery. And
I'm Venerable Jenti.
You've got to turn it on. Is it on? Is it on? Okay. And over on the other side, you don't have a microphone, do you want to? Okay. All right, okay, so we just go potluck and go for it. Okay, here we go. Right. So I'll read out the questions, and if it's not addressed to any nun in particular, especially a nun who's not here, dear Venerable Ajita, who's not here, then any one of us will try and answer it. Okay, so dear Venerable Ajita, who is not here, what does caring and taking responsibility without attachment to another person look like? What does caring and taking responsibility without attachment to another person look like? Jeez. Okay, again. What does caring and taking responsibility without attachment to another person look like? Okay, actually, let's keep that a mix because Venerable Ajita isn't even here. So, okay, let's.
Huh? Yeah. I guess in times of sickness as well, or any difficulties, you know, both parties work together as well. And it's, you know, you should try and bring in the skills of listening. And really, listening is an important skill in any relationship, and working together through, you know, whatever difficulties you're facing, and even in the time of death. I mean, this is, you know, when Buddhism comes in, you care, you love, you give, without trying to get emotional. Especially if someone is sick, you need to be strong to be able to support them. And this is where, you know, hopefully you know enough about Buddhism to help you deal with caring for this person in a caring way, but non-detached, non-emotional.
What are the fun and happy aspects of being a nun? Doing questions and answers when you've never done this before. What are fun and happy aspects of being a nun? Sisters, anyone want to say something?
I guess one of the nice things at Dharamsala is that we have quite a large community of nuns to live with. So I'm an only child, so it's nice to have a big family now to live in. I have lots of sisters and aunties, and that community aspect is quite fun. We also do lots of things which I never expected that I would be doing as a nun. So since coming to Dharmasara, I've learned how to use a chainsaw. I've driven a backhoe. We have a mini excavator, which I've learned to drive. I've done control burns with the fire brigade. So a nun's life is not boring. those are probably the two fun aspects for me.
One, two, three, four. Three questions. Do we get to choose where we will be born or choose our parents? Question number one. So maybe do we get to choose where we will be born or choose our parents? Well, maybe I'll just have a go at that. In a way, I think you do, but not precisely. I mean, it would be great to say, I'd like to have parents that don't fight and don't drink. And I mean, if it was that easy, we could. But I think I feel I was born to a Buddhist family because of my great interest in the Dhamma, probably from a previous life, that I personally feel I directed myself to be born to a spiritual family. So in a way, I think in this life, you can have so much love for the Dhamma and so much aspiration to follow this path that you just go there. You know what I mean? Like, you just look around and go, yeah, that one. That's how I feel. I mean, obviously, you can't be, perfectly. If it was that easy, you don't have perfect parents. So that's question number one. Question number two, can we choose not to be born, and where do we go if we still can't achieve stillness? Oh, damn. Can we choose not to be born, and where do we go if we still can't achieve stillness? On to another life. Can we choose not to be born? Does anyone want to say something about not choosing or not to be born? I don't think. Let's see.
Okay, I'll try my best. You don't have a choice. Death is certain, and where you're born is according to the karma you've made in this lifetime and your past lives too, I would say. So, however, you do have control of what you are doing in this life. If you are doing a lot of good deeds, helping people, providing service to your friends, your family, to all sentient beings, you can actually influence what kind of birth you're going to have. But it's actually uncertain. Karma is a very, very complex subject in how it works. The Buddha said that you can go crazy trying to figure out what it is and how it works. So that was the first part. And the other? There was something else to that same question. So the other part to it is if we can't achieve stillness, well, there are the stream entry, non-returner, once returner, non-returner. You could even be born in a deva realm. Again, comes back to the karma you've made, the deeds you've done, in all your lives, and so it's not all bad. Hopefully you won't go to a hell realm. So the only other thing I add is, do good. Do wonderful things. I mean, the fact that you're all here, and I've been just reflecting this afternoon on your conduct, you know, you've been very caring to all the other practitioners and, you know, walking quietly and being respectful of the monastics. And, you know, all the service you're doing here, you know, on the retreat and outside your lives too, you know, these are all positive good things. So keep on doing good. Then, you know, I don't think you've got much to worry about. Providing your past life, you know, what you've done there, which we none of us know, not even monastics. So, okay. All right. I know those who are generous and done a lot of good deeds will be born at a noble society or rich. How about good looking? And why some are born to be talented and more intelligent than average? Do we set to choose the looks and talents? Whoa, there's a few questions here, not just one. Does anyone?
I know, this is just quoting Ajahn Brahm. I know I've heard him say, if you ask lots of questions, you'll be born intelligent. So if you don't ask questions, you'll be born stupid. And I think good looking is, if you have lots of loving kindness and you're caring, then you'll be reborn good looking. So those two I can answer.
I don't think you necessarily, do we get to choose? I wish we could. But obviously not. I don't think we necessarily can choose, but heck, you know, you can always put your ballot in. Okay. Any nun to answer. Just before you left lay life to be a nun, did you find yourself feeling less inclined to engage in activities that seemed normal or even pleasurable to others, such as watching TV, movies, shopping, sightseeing? Did the job that you once found meaning in seem less meaningful?
For me, I think once you have tasted the Dharma, all the other worldly pleasures are tasteless.
I think that means yes.
Bansi? You're not a nun, but heck. There's a second part. Did the job that you once found meaning in seem less meaningful? So.
So I've worked for 24 years in IT. And maybe I'll just say, I think one of the questions was, whether... I led a sort of a life of, you know, quietness and solitude, and yes, I did. I never felt that I fitted in, you know. I worked for 24 years, but I was a loner, really. And I've grown up here, high school, and then, my friend went to university, and, you know, she liked to go clubbing. So, you know, she'd say, you know, I won't be your best friend if you don't go. So, you know, I'd be having this conversation on the phone. I don't want to go, you know, dancing, for instance. And it was like, I won't be your friend. And so, you know, so these type of tactics I can remember. So I was actually not really inclined to, you know, go out even as a young adult. And even in the workforce, I would say that I was pretty much alone. At lunchtime, I'd just go for a walk on my own. And, I did enjoy some things, you know, like choir. I was in a choir and things like that. So I think a lot of us maybe, I don't know, Maybe some of us are quiet. I'm not sure. I can't answer for the other nuns. I guess I was I got pretty disenchanted with work at the end. You know, the politics, the cutthroat. You know, I was thinking, you know, what is this? And you know, I was earning pretty good money, and you know, did everything. I could do everything, holidays, and you know, had great friends, family, everything. But there was no happiness. There was no peace. And in the end, I thought, you know, I just cannot exist. And the stress and everything too in IT, of those of you in that field, you'll have an idea how bad it can get. So I wanted out, but I wasn't sure whether, you know, the spiritual life was, you know, going to answer my questions and bring me peace, especially. So I sold the house and gave away all my stuff, and I thought I'll give it a go. I was taking a chance pretty much. I guess some of the nuns here, you know, have done retreats and all sorts of things. I really have had no experience in any of that, and including meditation. You know, the most I've done is maybe 1-2 day retreat. So I was really taking a stab in the dark. But I'm still, you know, I still have a long way to go in this spiritual life, but it's worth being in it, especially with my sisters. It's a wonderful community at Dhammasara. I would say one of the only, you know, nuns monastery, this larger community most likely, and we care for one another and we support one another, and I sure am glad I got out of the rat race.
Thank you. What do you like about being a nun?
Well, I'm not Venerable Ajita, but I guess one of the main things is the time and space that the lifestyle we live allows us to practice meditation, and that's one of the main reasons why I took it up. Like many of you, I started out as a retreat junkie, and and then it just occurred to me, I thought, why not go and stay at a monastery for a while just to see what it's like? I didn't go with the intention of thinking I want to be a nun. I just wanted to go somewhere different to the retreat centers I had been staying in, to try out something different and see what it was like. And once I was there, I saw that being a nun is basically, it's not like being on retreat full time. You have work and you have responsibilities, but it's the lifestyle that is most conducive and supportive for practicing a spiritual and meditative life. And so that's the one of the aspects that I like most about being a nun.
Okay. What do you like about being a nun? I guess it is the wholehearted devotion to the spiritual life from dawn to dusk. That is what is in your heart. Because I spent a week with my dear old parents just before coming to the retreat, and it was just so easy to start trying to work out what Mr. Trump was doing, what was going on with the energy policies of the world. My father has a TV on from all the time, watching the news. So just how different a life it is in the monastery, where you can't help but just be focused on what are my intentions? Am I doing this out of wholesomeness? Your mind is just so so on that track, you know? And what an opportunity, because really, what an opportunity. Yeah. I highly recommend it. Okay. What does the daily schedule of the monastery involve? Do you get to make conversation with other monastics and lay people? There's a whole like string of questions, so we'll start with the first one. What does the daily schedule of the monastery involve? So I'll just answer this. So we actually have a very, at the same at Bodhinyana, a very Ajahn Brahm kind of schedule. So we meet twice a week in the morning before for morning sits at 5. If not, it is our own practice. So we basically meet at 6:30 for breakfast. Before that, it's our own time to wake up as you see fit and practice, you know, what is according to your own needs. So some nuns wake up at 3, some nuns wake up at 4, some nuns, like me, wake up at 5. But, so we practice until in our own kutis, which we have our own little huts, and at 6:30 we meet for breakfast. And after breakfast we have a short work meeting, which is at about 7:15, and that's when we sort of work out what needs to be done and what has to be done. And so from that time until dana time, which is 10:30, earlier on really, we do whatever needs to be done in the monastery, sweeping, rake, you know, driving backhoes, cleaning toilets, painting, just kind of whatever needs to be done to keep the monastery going. So from 10:30 to about, that's when people come to the monastery and we have a little ceremony. It's a little bit different to Bodhinyana. Our abbot, who isn't here, Venerable Haspanya, gives a little Dhamma reflection and then lunch. And after that, we are free, essentially. We don't have any work per se. So after lunch, we wash our bowls, and the rest of the day is ours. Twice a week, we have a sit in the evening. So on a Wednesday, often we come to Bodhinyana to listen to Ajahn Brahm. If not, we're back in the monastery. So twice a week we meet, but the rest of the day essentially is our own time. So that's basically the schedule. Okay. So do you get to make conversation with other monastics and lay people? Do you get to make conversation with other monastics and lay people? The answer is yes. We do. It's not a retreat, it's our home, you could say. So, you know, we're like a family. We're pretty quiet after lunch, but definitely we talk to each other and learn from each other, you know, like, hey, you know, kind of. So we talk to each other and to lay people, not so much. We're kind of lucky in a way that I mean is that our abbot usually does the, like Ajahn Brahm does all the front end work, so she's the one who sort of, when people have problems they go to her, or so that's that. That's really good. Okay. Do you get fed up of too much meditation?
Paramita? Obviously not.
Not yet.
Yes, sometimes you can get fed up of meditation. If you're, like I said, it's not like doing a 10-day retreat. Sometimes there's no obvious start and there's no end, so it just kind of goes on and on. And if your practice, sometimes it doesn't go so well, so then you get restless and then you get fed up. But that's why it's nice to have work to do and have other nuns to go and talk to. So.
Yes,
I do get fed up. I get fed up with my body because it aches sometimes from sitting, long sitting. It's the five hindrances that come up, you know. Until we are arahants, it's there, you know. For those of you who don't know what the five hindrances are, it's restlessness, doubt, sloth and torpor, sensual desire, anger and ill will. So these things come up during meditation, and it can be a challenge. For me especially, I was trained in Melbourne, and I've been at Dhammasara now for over 1.5 years, and plus I've only have my teacher in Melbourne, and trying to get an understanding of the nuns and their personalities, why do some of them they may have a particular behavior and you don't understand it. And go back to your heart and you think, this person, said it in this way. And Ajahn Brahm talks a lot about, just because we're wearing robes, it doesn't mean that we are some holy people. We still have defilements. That's why we are nuns, to work on these defilements. They're right at your face, because as Venerable Upeka said, we got half a day, to be with ourselves and to face these things. And these things actually do come up during meditation, some misunderstanding that was had, why have I been asked to do this particular type of, job today, tiredness, weather, all sorts of things. But it's actually a beautiful opportunity to go back to your heart. There's no one really close by, and we're encouraged actually not to visit each other's huts and talk to one another. So to really, be with it, to sit with it, and to face it, which I guess in lay life you really don't have that opportunity. You don't have that time and space to process these things. That is the beauty of monastic life, because you've got no choice but to face your defilements, to try and solve them, to work through them. If you don't, it becomes a hindrance to your meditation practice.
So, do you sleep on the floor or on mats? Does life in the monastery feel too ascetic sometimes? Well,
we sleep on beds, and we have a hot shower, so it's not too ascetic, not really ascetic at all.
Oh, yes, okay, we all live in different accommodation. She lives in the luxury accommodation, Paramita. So we have different degrees of accommodation from where Paramita lives, which is where the trainees start. It's a block with a toilet, kind of similar to how Jhana Grove is, and all the way to caravan. So I lived in a caravan, Venerable Jayanti lived in it, the rest of us have lived in caravans. And but the majority of the nuns live in little brick huts, which have no electricity and running water, but just a tap, basically. Does it feel too ascetic? I have an ascetic streak in me, so I have no problem with it.
Yeah, I actually have a small bed in my hut, which one of the other nuns actually made. For me, it doesn't feel too ascetic. I like being outdoors. I like living simply. I think our monastery is actually probably quite comfortable compared to many monasteries in the world. So for me, it's not too ascetic. Yeah.
what are some of the manual labor tasks that you have to do? So we do cleaning of the area, all the way to building a whole complex. I don't know if you've been to the Nuns Monastery, but we have in the last, I don't know, few years anyway, an enormous sala complex, kind of with 15 new rooms and a hall and a kitchen, similar to Jhana Grove, but not as many rooms. So that is manual labor. A lot of the nuns were involved, not only paid work. So at that time, we were involved with just everything from carrying tiles. We have carried so many tiles, to painting, to we did a lot of the painting, to planting. We planted something like 4,000 plants along with volunteers. So we do a hang of a lot of manual work from using backhoes and all kinds of anything we can do, we do, basically. Anything to add? Yeah. Well, maintenance, like, you know, clean toilets. Yeah, feel not necessarily. We have like a couple of paid guys who come, John Field, and a couple of volunteer old retired men, and a couple of paid people as well who do sort of the heavy work. But drilling a hole and putting up a clock, I don't know. Yeah, fixing locks, you know, whatever little things that are we do ourselves. It's all kinds of things. And we do a lot of guy stuff because we don't have guys, so. Do you have heating and cooling in your huts? So we don't actually have cooling. Our huts are very well designed. They have double brick, so, and are sort of designed with roller shutters like you have here. So in the summer, what we do is we let the cool air in at night, and that cools down the bricks. And during the day, we put down the shutters, just as you do here, and the coolness stays in. So actually, they're surprisingly well designed. So we don't actually have cooling, but we do have gas heaters for the winter. So nothing, no electricity, just a gas bottle outside and heating. Yes. That's it? Another one. When we are born in this world, do we carry the past character into the next life? When we are born in this world, do we carry our past character in the next life?
Okay, I'll try my best. If you have a particular character, you know, some strength or weakness or things that you haven't worked through, yes, you will take it into the next life. And also your good qualities too, like, for instance, if you're a Dhamma practitioner, chances are, you know, if you're not an Arahant at the end of it, as Venerable Upeka was saying, you have an inclination to be born to a family that's practicing Dhamma, or maybe later on you will, you know, come across it.
Do you want to say something? Nothing to say? Just say if you want to say something. Yeah. your character in your next life. I think we're all so different because we're obviously carrying something from before. So, I mean, that goes without saying that, why are we so different? It must be something from before, no? Yeah, I think. Okay, here we go. Dear Bhikkhunis, is Ajahn Brahm really at Dhammaloka or did he go to watch the Australia Day festivities at Perth foreshore? I don't know, maybe he did. Generally in monastic life, if a nun gets dementia, who would look after her? Does she get sent to a nursing home? Well, you have to worry about that when I get dementia. I think it really depends on the community, and also if the community can support this particular nun and her needs. So there are in our case we are large, so we could probably work with it to some degree. But our previous abbot, Ajahn Vayama, who is, she doesn't have dementia, but she has a degenerative motor disease, which basically she needs full-time care. So she lives separately and is looked after by another nun. So it really depends on, at that time there was a very small community. There was only like four of them, so there wasn't. It just didn't work out. But I guess it depends on the community and the situation of that person. Just like any family, sometimes you just can't do it anymore. We're really like a family. We do our best to take care of each other. That's my the nun who ordained with me is now 75. She and she's, forgets her things. And so I run around and carry her bits and pieces. And she says, oh, I think I forgot my spectacles. So I run off and someone gets her spectacles. So it's just natural, really, to look after someone the best you possibly can. Yeah. Anything else? No? Okay. Now that you have become a monk and or a nun, how do you feel? Thank you. It's so inspiring to see such young people become monastics. Achala, you have to answer that question.
I guess I feel very glad that I'm a nun, basically. That doesn't mean that I'm happy all the time every day. Like anyone else, I have my ups and my downs, but I don't think... I've been at Dhammasara full-time since 2012, and I can honestly say there hasn't been a single day where I've thought, gee, I wish I was back at work. I just feel very glad to be a nun and very grateful for the conditions that we have. Like I mentioned earlier, I haven't stayed at any other monastery besides Dhammasara, and that was the first place that I went to when I ordained there. But the longer I live this life and I meet nuns from different monasteries in different parts of the world, I realize what good conditions the female monastics have here in Perth, which isn't available elsewhere in the world. So, yeah, I just feel more and more grateful, I guess.
Next one is specifically for Venerable Achala. What's one of your favorite things about Dhammasara?
I think I've already covered this before, so maybe we can do another question.
How does the hierarchy work with the monks and nuns? And how does the nun rise? How does the nun rise a level? How does the hierarchy work with monks and nuns? And how does the nun rise a level? Does someone want to answer that?
Me?
hierarchy, right? Okay. Okay. So the hierarchy with monks and nuns is a bone of contention. Basically, in the time of the Buddha, the monks stood there and then the nuns stood there. The monks walked ahead, traditionally, of the nuns. But I guess this is a 2,500-year-old tradition that has to be relevant to our day and age. And that just doesn't go down very well. So especially here in Western Australia, Rajan Ram is so supportive of and has encouraged the nuns to come out and, you know, not be behind hanging behind the apron, so say, of the monks. So hierarchy wise, we just go according to seniority. Whoever is a monk ahead of me stands, and whoever the monk behind me stands behind me. So that's a little bit out of how it's done in Asia, you could say. So that's hierarchy wise, and of course we're really given as much opportunity as the monks do in Perth here. So in terms of Venerable Haspanya being the abbot of, she has a lot of voice in the Buddhist society. Just because she's a female, she doesn't sort of take a back step. And how do the nuns rise a level? I'm not sure. Oh, Ray. Oh, okay, yeah. Just as long as you're there, as you know. We count ourselves by reigns, so if reigns is like the number of years you've been there. So if you've been there 1 year, you're one reign. If you've been there 2 years, you're two reigns. So that's how you rise up. It's just simply whoever came first. Yeah, so I came first. She came last. That's all. I think that answers the question. So dear nuns, could you each share with us your response to the following questions, please. 1, 2, and 3. Number 1, why did you become a nun? Number 2, what factors indicated that the timing for ordaining was right? In other words, how did you know you were ready? Number 3, once you ordained, what were three things about your life as a nun that you found difficult? Okay, so I'll start. Each nun. Phew. Okay, so why did you become a nun? Well, why did I become a nun? Because that was just the most obvious thing to do. Why did I become a nun? Yeah, just more, as you practice more, you kind of go, you just want to dedicate your whole life to this. There's just no question about it. So that's why I became a nun, in short. And number 2, what factors indicated that the timing for ordaining was right? In other words, how did you know you were ready? So actually for me, I took about 10 years to maybe more. I remember when I was about 14 watching an ordination and going, wow, is that possible? It was just a thought that went through a little girl's head. But when was the time right? Well, when I was, unlike Venerable Jayanti, I'm a very conservative type. So even though I sort of thought this was a good thing to do, I didn't. I got married instead. And did a lot of things that that I felt I needed to get out of my system. I was young at that time, when at about 25, I thought this is important. I went on a lot of retreats and went on a lot of long retreats, and just felt that I had was grounded in my practice, you could say. For me personally, of course, everyone's different. And then one day I just woke up and thought, well, you know, it's obvious. It's time. It was just so obvious. So that's for me. And once you ordained, what were three things about your life as a nun that you found difficult? When I first ordained, that I found difficult, I just thought it was the most amazing thing ever. And like Venerable over there was just full of just, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I really can't remember when I was first ordained what was difficult, because really I can't think of it right now. But as time goes on, your mind catches up with you and you find yourself, you know, having problems that you really don't have. And three things that I find difficult. Junior nun suffering. You know, I can't do it. Why you can't do that? I can do that. You know, so not being allowed to do what I think should be done. That's one. Three things. Myself. So, going back to your kuti and your mind just isn't what it you would like it to be. So that's year in, year out, you go, surely I've gotten over that one, but no, you haven't. I've been at Dhammasara now eight and a half years, and I'm still fairly unenlightened. And yeah, so that's a bit, you know, oh my God, sometimes. And three things. That sort of covers it all. Yeah. Okay.
I think I answered the first one. I became a nun, pretty much disenchanted with work and not having, you know, getting any peace or happiness there. The second one, timing, 24 years in the workforce was enough for me to work out that, you know, this is just not the the direction of what my life to move in. And when you've had that much of suffering in the workforce, and towards the end there was, I thought that it was time to get out. It was very clear. I wasn't certain that this life would actually, answer my questions or bring me, you know, peace. But my family are Buddhist as well, and I'm Sri Lankan. I'm more Australian than Sri Lankan because I've been here for a long time. But in my horoscope, because in Sri Lanka horoscopes are written, my mum said that it was written that I will become a nun. I will be in the world, but I will become a nun, which I find quite interesting. So maybe this is, you know, I think all of us here, including Venerable over there, we must have had some sort of spiritual life in the past to be actually ordained, a rare opportunity. Three things that are difficult. Okay. So for me, it was really difficult because I think Venerable Paramita has been in the workforce for I don't know how long, but two nuns here, Venerable Achala is very young, only a few years in the workforce, I think, and not long, Venerable Lupeka. So there's a lot. It's a whole lifestyle change. It's a lot of conditioning, you know, that I had, I guess, being in the workforce, and you know, things are done differently, as you would know, those of you who work And then to come into an environment, I was, you know, trained in a house, a suburban house in Melbourne, with a teacher, pretty much, you know, be worried for 2.5 years. A teacher may not necessarily point out your faults, but that's the style, you know, of, you know, teacher I had, and she expected me to figure things out, and you know, if I didn't, you know, after a while, she would just, you know, say, you know, you're doing this, and you know, you need to think about it. And in the workforce, you know, it's about survival. And it's a totally different thing. It's actually, you know, being considerate and respectful to your teacher, not talking back, not, formulating your own opinion. All of these things, as Venerable Bhikkhu said, you know, doing things your own way, that all goes out the window. You have a schedule. You are expected to, have a certain behavior when you're in the presence of lay people. So really, it's actually you're brainwashing yourself to be something else. That took a while, and my teacher said that I was a hard nut to crack, and that is true. I really was. I gave a few headaches. And at the end of the day, it's only the defilements. You have to think about the community you're in, the lay people who are supporting you, all the requisites that we get, and really trying to... At that early stage, you're trying to live up to all those things that you're given, the support, the care of your teacher, the community. And at the start, it's a big thing to live up to. And in a way, not having a large community to live in, to be with, I find it really, really difficult. Some of the problems, you know, that I, you know, couldn't talk to my teacher about. So I was, lost sometimes, and didn't know what to do, you know, when, there are certain situations. So but the good thing is that you learn. I found that the environment that I was trained in, I did become resilient. There's a lot of problems that I had to that I encountered and that I've had to overcome to be now here at Dhammasara, where I find it a very supportive, conducive environment to practice. So for me, I guess the earlier days, you know, there were some hardships, but they have taught me a lot, and hopefully enough resilience to continue in this monastic life, because sometimes it's not easy at all. From lay people looking in, you might think, oh, you know, you meditate all day, you can have naps, you can, you know, have a pretty easy life, you're supported, you're given everything, but being with your defilements, facing your unhappiness, and having to deal with all these things it can be hard. But thankfully, we have Venerable Hasapani Ajahn Brahm around, and this great nuns community. So for me, I think things are changing.
So I'll start with the last part of the question first. When I first ordained, I guess I thought I was ordaining basically to meditate, to practice, and I had to cook and drive for the nuns and do all sorts of other odd jobs around the place, and I didn't think that that was part of my practice, and I found that really difficult at first. after a while of listening to a lot of Ajahn Brahm talks and Venerable Hasapanya, I realized that's part of the practice, and giving service is good and actually feeds back into your meditation. Another thing that I found difficult was living with other people, because other people can be really annoying, basically. but again, it's difficult, but that's also something that's really good for your practice, just to learn to get along with other people. And the last thing is, when you ordain, you actually give up a lot of control. So yes, you get a lot of time and space to meditate, but you're also giving up a lot of control over your life. So we don't handle money, and I can't drive, so I can't just take off because I got angry and go to the beach, or things that I used to do to let off steam, I can't do anymore. So those were the three things, I think, that I found most difficult when I first ordained. The timing for ordaining, I didn't think about it too much. I basically just thought, I'll become an anagarika, which is the first step towards ordaining, where you wear white and live in the monastery. And I didn't think beyond that. I thought, I'll just do that for 1 year and then see how it goes. And each step along the way, that's basically all I did. Why did you become a nun? I think I sort of covered this, but basically I was working and I had already started doing retreats when I was at university. And I realized more and more that my happiness came from the meditation retreats I was doing and not from working. I liked my job, but yeah, it didn't give me the sense of fulfillment and happiness that I got from meditating.
When I was a layperson, even though I live quite a comfortable life, but there is this a kind of sadness in my heart, a kind of genuine sadness, even though I enjoy my life as a layperson. One day, I asked myself, if you were to die today, tonight, what would you do today? And then I answer myself, would you like to go to work as usual? No way. Would you like to spend the rest of the day with your family just to stick together for the last day of your life? Not really. Then what do you want to do? And then I answer to myself, if today were the last day of my life, I would like to go to a monastery. I would like to serve the community and the monastery. I would like to have some quiet time, just be with myself, maybe go into the meditation hall and meditate. And then that's a good way to pass away, in a meditation hall, meditating. That's why I become a nun. So the timing, it just happened. And what were the three things about your life that as a nun that you found difficult? To acknowledge the defilements in myself, to face them, and to find skillful means to deal with them.
Maybe not quite, maybe 10 questions. So anyone is free to leave at any time, because there seems to be a lot more questions here. What's the difference between that and me reading it out? Faster. Okay, faster. How about I read it fast? Yeah, there's some hell of a long ones. Okay, here we go. Okay. So, So, dear Venerable Upeka, that's me, what's one of the most eccentric things you've seen or done at Dhammasara? Right. Eccentric things you've seen and done at Dhammasara. There's a lot. The building project was pretty wacky because, you know, you're a girl, you've never been chainsawing and carrying bricks and painting walls. And what's the most eccentric thing? Laying concrete, putting down tiles, building our own kuti. I don't know. The list is, yeah, out there. I know, what's eccentric? Never mind, off he goes. Okay. Dear Venerable Number Four, what is the best thing about your companions at Dhammasara? Best things.
They are fun to be with. They are fun. Yes. And they are very kind. Basically, they are very warm. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. I feel very peaceful and contented here. I'm almost scared to go back to the real world and be too overwhelmed. Do you have any advice on how to remain peaceful inside?
Become a monk or a nun.
Have a really simple life. Don't make your life complex.
There you go. Okay, here we go. Dear Venerable, I found walking and observing nature is pleasant and calming. But does admiring and delighting in nature, seeing trees, oceans, count as a hindrance as rupa? To the form of, you know, basically, are you indulging in the sense world? Thank you. So I'll just have a go at this. Well, I personally find living in the forest in extremely inspiring, and I'm sure I don't see anything wrong with that. I guess if it leads to a sense of peace, then why the heck not? Yeah. What do you think? Yeah? Good. Done. Okay. Okay. Is there a waiting list of suitable candidates who would like to train and ordain as a nun at Dhammasara Monastery? And if so, how long is it? What qualities might be taken into account? Well, the way it works is... basically, if you are under the age of 50, have reasonable good health, so under the age of 50, reasonable good health, and if you are a resident of Australia or New Zealand, where you can have residency in Australia anytime, basically, you're welcome to come. So if you are an Australian or New Zealand resident, under the age of 50, of reasonable health, you can pretty much walk in, I'd say. And if you're a woman. but if you are a non-Australian, then the list gets quite long, because there's obviously a whole planet full of people. Then that gets a bit tricky. That's where the waiting list really is of non-Australians. So what qualities might be taken into account? Really, nothing. just give it a shot. And then as you come in, the monastery sees what you're like, you see what the monastery is like, maybe you like it. You know, there's no sort of CV that you have to present. So, just give it a go. You just write and say, I would like to come and try. So in the first 3 months, you is the time when you just come in as a visitor and you get a good idea what the monastery is like. The monastery gets a good idea what you are like. And within that 3 months, a relationship forms. And then there's a year that you spend as an invite after that before you ordain. And again, that's a sort of toing and froing time where you can decide whether you want to continue or not. So basically, you come in and see how it goes. Does that make sense? Great. Okay. So, please describe a day in the life of a nun. So I think we did that, didn't we?
We did that one.
Okay. So, what prompted each of you to this monastic life? I think we did that one too.
Yeah, we did that one.
Okay. Do nuns get annoyed at each other?
We did that one.
Is there organizational politics?
Well, you just like, you know, a family, I think you just get annoyed at each other, but you forgive each other and you kind of, you know, you love each other anyway. It's not so much an organization. I think of it more like family. You love each other at the end of the day because you have no choice. Anyone want to say anything?
Okay, done. Okay.
Tell me if I'm going too fast, right? No?
No, not too fast. Okay, I am aware of nuns invited to do the Friday night talks. Are the retreats as well, not to push aside the monks, but the more the perspectives, the better. With lots of metta, thank you. Are nuns invited to the Friday night talks? Are there retreats as well? Well, yeah. Venerable Hasapanya, our abbot, goes down to Dhammaloka quite regularly. I think in the last few years you haven't seen us because of the our building project. I think Ajahn Brahm gave us a lot of time off to just get the buildings built, so you didn't see the nuns for a couple of years, probably quite as much. But and now Ajahn Venerable Hasapanya goes down much more often, and she also has been giving retreats, weekend retreats, and you are always welcome to come and stay with us. There's accommodation for like 9 women, at least 6 women. So if you're a woman, you can always come and live the life of a nun. Yeah. Okay. So, Sister Rupeka, that's me. As the Buddha was a man, do you find the teachings coming from a male perspective or unisex? Find the teachings come from a male perspective or unisex and written for all? As a woman and a nun, what is your perspective? From a male perspective. Personally, didn't even occur to me, really. Certainly there are cultural, in the Vinaya, the rules that we hold, there are definitely rules that were appropriate to India of 2,500 years ago. But in terms of the Dhamma, the Buddha was extremely forward-thinking and extremely open-minded. There's no doubt about his compassion and openness to women. That the fact that he ordained women 2,500 years ago and people of all castes just shows how amazingly open-minded he was. So I personally don't find that being a woman that the Dhamma isn't relevant. But true, the Vinaya is much more much more definitely time and culturally different. Anyone want to say anything? Yes? No? Go on.
I think the basic defilements that the Buddha was addressing probably hasn't changed in 2,500 years. So personally, I find the teachings quite relevant, and I still have the same defilements that people did many years ago. So, yeah.
Okay. Dear Ajahn.
That's not us.
But never mind. Next time you publish a new book, you can print your signature on the front cover, so that way people will not ask for your signature again. Thank you.
There you go. That's what I want.
Right. Thanks for taking care of us tonight. Could any of you express your opinion on the importance of patience towards yourself and others? And if you have any advice on how to add more frequently in our lives, how to be more patient. Importance of patience towards others. I think, you know, the more I practice, the more I kind of accept that, oh my God, this is so important, patience. Because you start off, you've got all the formula, you kind of go, oh yeah, Buddha said yes, patience is the ultimate austerity, yeah, sure. And then many years down the road, you go, okay, patience is the ultimate austerity. Because you just have to, or else you go bananas. The importance of patience, I'd say that it is just so tragically important. Towards yourself and others, terribly, 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 terribly important. And advice on how to add it more frequently in our lives. Anyone else want to have a go? More frequently in our lives?
Sometimes we do feel impatient. So what I do is, when I feel impatient, I step back and watch the restlessness, the impatience. Then I become more patient.
Okay. Dear Venerable, is the nun's robe the same as the monk's robe? It looks thicker and heavier. Please pardon me for asking. So it is exactly the same. Different nuns in different cultures, you might have noticed, wearing different robes. In Burma, they wear bright pink. In Thailand, they wear white. But here in Dhammasara, we wear exactly the same as what the monks do. It is not thicker. It is perhaps the darker color may make it appear to look thicker, but it is exactly the same. Heavy? Okay. Right. Any nuns here had children? Could they answer, please, how they did it? If you have children to raise and aging parents, how do you leave lay life to become a nun? In your heart, you want to become a nun, but your family responsibilities are too heavy. Thank you. Well, none of us have had children. So unfortunately, it was we can't help you with that question. However, there are two nuns, abbot included, who have been mothers, and Venerable Gautam, who's my friend 75, who's definitely had four children. I think for her, she waited until her children grew up. But having young children, it would be rather heartbreaking, I would say. I don't know. I can't answer that question. I can't answer that. What I can say is I'm glad my mom didn't become a nun. But anyway. So I'm sorry, I can't really help you with that. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you please tell us the story of the monks and the weathermen? That's not ours. Monks and the weathermen. Dear Venerable Achala, dear Venerable, there are so many distractions and expectations for young people. As someone the same age as you, I do think all that metta and meditation has made you preserve your youthful looks better. What is your advice on overcoming these obstacles on the middle path? Second, what made you decide to become a nun at such a young age? With much metta and love.
I think basically do what you're doing now, which is come to places like Dhyana Grove, hang out at Dhammaloka, join the Kalyanamitta group at Dhammaloka, just hang around like-minded people, and hopefully they will help you not get distracted so much. It's not like I said before, it's not like I woke up one day and said, I want to become a nun. It was just through doing retreats and hanging out at monasteries and retreat centres. It was kind of a very slow and gradual process. I think that's the only advice I can do, is just hang around good people and you'll get conditioned in a good way, basically. So, yeah, that's it.
Okay. Is it wrong to want the judging to go? Is it wrong to watch the want the judging to go? Is it wrong to want the judging to go? Well, you want to go?
Well, the word want is a problem. remember, Ajahn used the example, I want happiness. You cross out the I, you cross out the want, what do you have? Happiness. Right? So you actually... accepting judging is the first thing, acknowledging that you're judging somebody, judging yourself, first step. And then not giving yourself a hard time for having that judgmental mind. And in time you observe yourself when you're judging yourself and others. And then you make a determination that, the Buddha's teaching, it's actually not beneficial to you or to others having that judgmental mind because you don't feel good about it. And in time, gradually, that judgmental mind would subside. All on its own.
Okay. So, next question. To all the dear nuns, what is your greatest challenge in being a disciple of Ajahn Brahm? How will we start from the other end?
Because I have just been a novice nun for 3 months, so I'm still in honeymoon. So maybe you can ask the nuns who are more years in seniority.
Well, one is having to do the Friday night Q&A when he's not here. Because Ajahn Brahm is an incredible... public speaker, and I hate public speaking, so he's left very big shoes to fill. The greatest challenge, I think, sometimes because Ajahn Brahm emphasizes the jhanas and the nimittas and all these beautiful states in meditation so much. You hear about this all the time and you're not there yet, or sometimes you're very far away from that. And so that can be a bit difficult sometimes, because he does go on about those things a lot. yeah, I think that would be what I would say, the greatest challenge.
I actually, I don't, I have to honestly say I don't find it a challenge. I find him very inspiring. And having been trained in Melbourne and not having access to him for, you know, my initial training, you know, just, you know, downloaded talks and listening to that and not having, much contact with him, I would say that he's one of the reasons I chose this life, because Mum and I used to listen to his talks. So I find him absolutely amazing, compassionate, human being, and I hope he's around for a lot longer, because I'm a long way from enlightenment.
Okay, what is your greatest challenge being a disciple of Ajahn Brahm? I would have to agree with Venerable Achala, because I found his teachings very sort of, it doesn't work for me, it works for you, it doesn't work for me. When I first heard him, I mean, there's no doubt that he was saying something incredibly profound and meaningful. So I found that, yeah, just hey, Ajahn, what? I'm not there, kind of thing. So that is a challenge. But I think over the years, he's also come down to mere mortal levels. Personally, I think, and also I've sort of maybe openly got to improve myself a little bit. But yeah. Okay. But I have to agree with Venerable Jayanthi as well, that he is an incredible person to be around and to have alive. I mean, it's just, you wouldn't want to be anywhere else, really. Yeah. Okay. Can you please tell us how, when you decided to become a nun, and what inspired you? So I think we've done that one, no? We've done that one, yeah. Okay. Hello. I read that some of the precepts for the nuns are different than for the monks, or there are more precepts for nuns. What are the differences? So we keep 311 precepts. That's a lot. And the monks keep a mere 227. The differences are actually, a lot of them, the way I see it, are just irrelevant. They're just small little things. But the major difference is, I think, protection for women. So one of the big difficulties with the bhikkhuni ordination was that say a woman can't travel alone without without the company of another bhikkhuni. So this is actually considered a very serious offense, a sangha disesa, not to travel alone. I can see the spirit of the rule is that women in those days in India were definitely very much more vulnerable than they are here, going around from one village to another, walking by yourself, you're sure to get into trouble, and probably still is the same. But so a lot of the differences are to do with the safety of women. But they have been, you could say, jiggled and reinterpreted, not reinterpreted, just taken, say, we take the spirit of the rule, and the word, you know, sort, we keep the spirit. And in certain cases, we keep the rule, but not the spirit, sort of. Anyway, putting myself in. But so the differences are basically to do with safety, but the basic rules, we are all celibate, we, you know, don't handle money, and the basic things about being a monk or a nun are the same. Anyone else say anything? No. Right. Okay. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ram, dear Ajahn again. I can go away too. And this is a dear Ajahn too. And that's a dear Ajahn too. Oh gosh, I think these are kind of serious questions at the bottom here. Huh? Yesterday. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. That's also a very serious question. And that's also Ajahn Brahm question. And one serious question. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you tell us a story about heavenly beings? Oh, boy. Okay, that sounds like fun. Heavenly beings? Didn't he do this one? He did this, didn't he? He did. He did. Okay. Okay, let's try a serious one then. Because we come to the end. Oh, no, here's one more. Here's one more that was long, but... So I left it, but it's kind of just detailed. If you want to be a nun, I heard that you need to spend 3 months in Rains Retreat to place the application. Number one, is the Rains Retreat 3 months? Yes, it is. And you need to spend 3 months in Rains Retreat to place the application. No, you don't. You have to stay 3 months. Then that's not necessarily during the rains period. It could be any 3 months. So I'm right on that? Yeah. If you cannot attend during this period due to inappropriate something, commitment or something, can you choose to spend an alternative period? Yes, you can. And number three, how many people are currently in the waiting list? This, I said, it depends on whether you're, basically, if you're Australian or New Zealander, there's very little waiting time. But if you are a non-Australian, the waiting time is very long. And how many places are generally made available every year? We're actually just filling up the new complex that we built. So there are like 6 rooms and... We only started taking, like for many years we weren't taking in people, and last 2 years ago we took a whole batch in. So we've still got a few spaces. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Once you complete your 5-year training, do you need to leave the monastery to make room for other trainees? Well, I have been there 8.5 years and I'm still there, so... the problem is that there's not many places to go as a bhikkhuni, especially, and as we are still kind of the whole bhikkhuni order is so young, just sending a bhikkhuni out to fend for herself, unlike monks, it's just not very possible, really. So it's all just growing, and we'll see what happens. We're all a very young community as well. So unlike the monks, we don't have that many places to go to. Yeah. And that is that. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So thank you, everybody, for listening to us very patiently and very tolerantly until 10 o'clock at night, and it's a privilege to share the Dhamma and to share our experience, and our mortal minds are not too different from yours. Yes, and thank you, Bhante, as well for being here and contributing. And anyone else wants any last words? No. Okay, thank you, everybody.